for today. I have on the line Stuart Patrick of the Council of Foreign Relations. He is a senior fellow. And my name is Charles Cotillo from the Royal Historical Society. I'm here to discuss with Stuart his new book, The Sovereignty Wars, Reconciling America with the World. Let's jump right in. What would you say, Stuart, is the primary thesis of your book? And what is its novelty as opposed to what other people have written about it?
Well, the primary thesis is that it's quite possible for the United States, contrary to conventional wisdom, to participate in international cooperation, including international organizations and treaties, without sacrificing its independence. The novelty of the book is that it's the first real examination of why the sovereignty debate in the United States is so complex and confused and polemic. And it also deals quite a bit with Donald Trump's particular approach to sovereignty, which is really the most full-throated defense of, in his mind, American independence and freedom of action that we've seen basically since the United States embraced global leadership at the end of the Second World War. It's really timely in that regard because it explains the thinking that's gone into what the president thinks and his senior advisors and much of his base as well.
Hasn't there always been this conflict, in the words of the late Harvard professor Stanley Hoffman, in American foreign policy, between what he called or termed primacy versus world order? And isn't this, in essence, your book is a rediscovery or a deep investigation into those two possible roads to American leadership abroad?
There definitely has been for a long time this inbuilt tension of the United States as the primary power or the hegemon, if you will, internationally, and the degree to which it's willing to play by the rules set for others. The United States, as many have pointed out beforehand, is much better at wanting to have rules that are binding on others while retaining freedom of action. But that's really more a debate about that's quite common in the academic literature surrounding realism, which is that you would expect a big power, in a sense, the world's most powerful country, to throw its weight around. What's, I think, unique in my argument is that I look at a lot of other aspects of American sovereignty. This isn't just a desire for freedom of action. It's a great sensitivity, sometimes verging on paranoia, that the United States is, in a sense, going to have its constitution and even internal freedoms strangled by or infringed upon by international action and international entanglements. And this touches very deeply on aspects of American political culture, not least the commitment to popular sovereignty in the United States that has been there since the foundation, but also a sense of American exceptionalism. So it's not simply the sort of traditional great power discomfort with rules binding and constraints. It's really more of a question, or at least as much of a question, of some sort of adulteration of the American way of life. And that's really what I try to explore in this book.
How would you differentiate the Trump version of this sovereignty, for lack of a better expression, obsession with people abroad, say like Boris Johnson or Viktor Orban or Marie Le Pen?
Right. I think that, there are certain aspects of it which are similar. I think when you think about people like Marine Le Pen and Viktor Orban in particular, sovereignty there is really, there's a blood and soil conception of the nation. And the idea here is that, you know, the concept of sovereignty begs the question or raises the question of, well, you know, who do you actually mean by the people who are sovereign? And in a lot of these places, sovereignty is really about, where your root stock came from in sort of, you know, genetic or blood terms. And I think that has been, that is often the way it's played with these nationalist populist movements abroad. The United States, of course, has been based on the proposition, it hasn't always been honored, but the proposition that in a sense we are a universal community open to all who come from other places around the world, provided that they accept the basic principles that are at the heart of the U.S. American Constitution and our other founding documents. Now, Donald Trump has verged sometimes, as well as many of the people in the alt-right and white nationalists, some of whom are his supporters, has verged and moved a little bit more occasionally into this more nativist viewpoint. But I think, to be fair to the president and many of his staunchest supporters, I think what he is drawing on is not simply this nativist view of what the people are, nor simply great power view. It's, I think, there's a major emphasis on the fact that international entanglements are diluting the U.S. Constitution and the sovereignty of the people, and that we are increasingly caught in a web of international law, of international treaties and organizations. My thesis of the book is that actually we're quite good at defending ourselves against these perceived incursions on what I call sovereign authority. We're very good at defending the U.S. Constitution, unlike what Boris Johnson talked about. We are not in a position where we are in a country that is subordinate, as Britain was in certain ways, to a supranational, that is a hierarchical body like the European Union. Our involvement in international organizations like the United Nations is much more of a horizontal arrangement. These are intergovernmental bodies. So what Boris Johnson was complaining about, I think, was something, he made this point, was something that Americans would never have countenanced, which is that we would never join a supranational body in which, say, a European Court of Justice or a European Commission would actually be able to tell us what to do. The United States simply doesn't accept a higher authority.
That's why the United States has still not signed, you could argue, the treaty relating to the International Criminal Court.
Absolutely. That's an excellent example of why we haven't done that. The ICC, while it has many laudable aspects, and of course, for people who care about international justice and accountability for atrocities and other war crimes, it has a lot of positive aspects. But the one sticking point, and this was true even under Democratic administrations, which is why we didn't make a move to ratify it during the Obama nor the Clinton administrations, is that it has an independent prosecutor who has the power, should he or she choose to do so, to basically pass judgment on whether or not the United States had conducted credible investigations of its own personnel in war zones as to whether or not they had committed atrocities. And that really is just incompatible with the U.S. Constitution, which places the Constitution and our own court system above all else as the ultimate foundation of American law.
On page 14, you make reference to American, quote, sovereignty has never been absolute. Can you elaborate a bit on that statement?
Yeah, sure. Sovereignty is basically the notion that the fundamental political unit of world politics is the state, and that the state has, at least as a matter of authority, should have supreme authority over its inhabitants, over its territory, and over its borders. Now, in point of fact, there obviously have always been violations of sovereignty. Countries have intervened against one another despite even explicit rules against that within the United Nations Charter. Even the most powerful countries in the world, including the United States, have difficulty controlling, as a practical matter, controlling their borders. So there have always been exceptions to basically the rights of sovereignty. They tend to be in the minority. So countries that violate other countries' sovereignty, for instance, tend to make justifications for it. And they're also not just de jure or legal sovereignty has been occasionally violated, but de facto sovereignty or empirical sovereignty is violated on a daily basis by you know, drug traffickers and smugglers and others. So it's a general rule. It is the most fundamental. It remains the most fundamental rule of international order. The entire surface of the globe, save Antarctica and maybe a couple of other places, small little places, are basically divided into sovereign states. But as a rule, states have often struggled to try to reconcile their constitutional independence and their alleged freedom from intervention with the fact that reality in an interdependent planet is quite messy and only getting more so.
In the book, you make reference several times to sovereignty bargains. What is that exactly, and why is it important?
Well, I began to reference that sovereignty has a number of different components, and I really focus on three of these. And I introduce, just for conceptual clarity, a figure that I call the sovereignty triangle. So if you'll bear with me, it has, as all triangles do, has three points or three corners. And at the top is sovereignty as authority. That means that that the state has legal and authority, it has constitutional independence, and that it recognizes no supreme or superior authority. You may recall the those old ads for Hebrew National hot dogs, which said that that others may be substandard, but we need to appeal to a higher authority, meaning, of course, God in this case.
Yes.
For the kosher hot dogs. The United States does not, as a matter of course, in political terms at least, recognize any higher authority. And that's basically what that means. There's a second corner, which is autonomy or freedom of action. And that aspect of sovereignty is, look, we don't want to be like Gulliver on a beach, tied down by Lilliputians. And that's about freedom of action. And then there's a third component of sovereignty called that I call influence, which is really the ability of our country to make to shape our destiny in a very complicated world. So you have these three aspects of sovereignty, which sometimes need to be traded off against one another. And when people make arguments about sovereignty, they need to specify, are we talking about, hey, the Constitution, that is authority? Are they talking about, hey, we want to be free as a practical matter in terms of to have a room for maneuver? And then the third is, well, we want to influence our destiny as a nation. The most powerful and provocative debates over sovereignty tend to be about that top corner, which is authority. There's this notion that somehow international law and international treaties and organizations are running roughshod over America's constitution and really subordinating us to things like, say, the International Criminal Court, or imagining the world as some sort of large European Union that is constraining us. In fact, I argue that we're very, very good at defending ourselves from incursions of international law, and we put huge amounts of reservations on treaties and things like that. The much more typical sovereignty bargain that I say that we do confront and need to make is between this notion that we have, as because we're so powerful, we should have independent freedom of action or autonomy. That actually is very it's illusory often, because the United States frequently can't get what it wants in a global age. But, you know, when you have transnational problems like climate change or epidemics or weapons of mass destruction or terrorist organizations, pandemic disease, etc. What I argue is that frequently we have to make sovereignty bargains, and that means trading off some level of autonomy for practical influence. The idea is to move from independent or unilateral action to collective action, and that's the argument that I make. That's the sovereignty bargain that we are increasingly going to have to face as a country.
Can you expand a bit on your statement on page 18? Effective sovereignty is not the absence of foreign entanglements, but the extensiveness of a country's links with the outside world.
Right. I think that this is really getting to the heart of the matter. I think that when people think of sovereignty, I use I sort of use an analogy that, you know, it's as if, you know, many people think, you know, it's the power to be left alone, and I invoke Greta Garbo, right? That you know, it's yes. She famously, she said, "I want to be alone," right?
Yes.
And then I say that actually, you know, in a networked world of transnational common problems, it's really a little bit more like Mark Zuckerberg and how many hundreds of millions of friends he has on Facebook. You know, one can exaggerate that, and just having connections is no panacea. But the argument here is that the more problems get to be transnational and cross-border, the way to actually effectively engage or effectively express your sovereignty is actually forming partnerships and alliances and networks with others. And here's an example of that. You know, a lot of people think, well, when it comes to security matters, wow, the United States really needs to sort of fortify those borders and sort of look after itself. But if, as a practical matter, think of weapons of mass destruction. It's quite possible that at some stage somebody could put a nuclear device or certainly a radiological device into a shipping container. Now, only about 2, 3, maybe 4% of shipping containers that arrive in the United States are actually inspected with any degree of rigor. To try to deal with this problem, there's something called the Container Security Initiative, which is a partnership between the United States and perhaps a couple of dozen other countries that have major shipping terminals. Think Singapore or Rotterdam or Yokohama, for instance, but also Long Beach and Seattle. Now, as part of this sovereignty bargain that we've made, we actually, not only do we have U.S. customs officials in those ports walking those docks, we actually have Japanese customs officials, for instance, walking the port of Long Beach and Canadians in Seattle. Now, a lot of people who take a little bit more of a defensive attitude towards sovereignty would freak out about that and think, wait a second, didn't the Japanese attack us in 1941? Or why are there foreigners inspecting, helping us inspect shipping containers or inspecting containers bound for them? But that is an example of the sort of bargains we need to make, and they need to be reciprocal bargains. If we're going to ask others to make certain sacrifices or compromises for our security, we've got to be prepared to do the same for theirs.
I was impressed by the way you handle the Treaty of Westphalia, going back a little bit into the historical concept of sovereignty, because usually there is a division between political scientists and international relations specialists and historians. The former usually regards Westphalia as sort of a foundation stone or dividing line between medieval-type mixed sovereignties and absolute sovereignty of the modern era, whereas historians generally tend to, for lack of a better expression, regard this as being nonsensical, because there was lots of examples post-Westphalia of mixed sovereignties or sovereignties which are not absolute, but only not 100%. Could you expand a little bit on your view of Westphalia and how it relates to the present concepts of sovereignty?
Certainly. I agree. I think that you know, there's a tendency, particularly amongst political scientists and to some degree international relations scholars, as opposed to historians who have a much deeper knowledge of and a sense of the nuance. I think there's a tendency amongst political scientists to try to portray 1648 with the treaties that ended the Treaties of Westphalia that ended the 30 Years' War. There's a tendency to suggest that this is some sort of stark dividing line, in the same way that, you know, one looks at, you know, 1066 and, you know, everything automatically changed in the mind's eye in Britain when William the Conqueror, you know, won at the Battle of Hastings. What you have to recognize is that it's simply one milestone in a much more gradual transition between a world of a really heterodox world of different and overlapping authority claims within Europe, where you had, you know, the church and the Holy Roman Emperor competing with one another, and you had you know, city states, leagues of city states, overlapping authorities, so that, you know, the king of France could be also, in a sense, the vassal to the Duchy of Burgundy, for instance. But the point that I make is that there was this transition to gradually to a more a situation where, over time, the authority claims of rulers became paramount over particular territories. And obviously, it took many decades, even centuries, for certain states, not least the German state, of course, and the Italian state, to coalesce into anything resembling what they are today. Furthermore, when you think about, even though the state coalesced within Europe in many of the powers that ended up becoming the most powerful in the world, as those European empires, as those European countries developed overseas empires, of course, they were not granting any sovereignty to the inhabitants of those countries. So you didn't really get or those territories. So you really didn't get the creation of a fully functioning sovereign state system, arguably, until the end of the Second World War, and even after a couple of decades afterwards, where you got, through the process of decolonization, in a sense, the extension of this notion of the sovereign state system throughout the entire surface of the world, again, save Antarctica. So it is a much more it was much more
fluid
situation, indeed.
And I suppose the best example is, again, looking at it from a historian's perspective, is pre-1914 Germany, the Kaiserreich, where you had a situation where the constituent states of the Reich, like Bavaria or Saxony, would not only have ambassadors, their own foreign ministries, with ambassadors in London, Paris, and Petersburg, but they even had an ambassador in Berlin representing Bavaria vis-a-vis the Imperial German state. And I suppose the other more pertinent contemporary example, this would probably be, I think you go a little bit into it, is mixed sovereignty, is the United States' relations with American Indians, which are treaty relationships which have been validated by the Supreme Court, I think almost 200 years ago.
Indeed. There are over 500, I believe, recognized Native American, American Indian tribes and other indigenous peoples within the 50 United States. And yeah, they abide under the Constitution other statutes, actually maintain significant degrees of sovereignty. Another aspect of sovereignty, which I address in the book, is, and it's very interesting because I go back and spend a lot of time on this sort of debates over sovereignty amongst the founders and the founding generation and of the United States. And many of the debates that occurred during the time of the Articles of Confederation and then in Philadelphia and the Constitutional Convention were really about how one should divide up the sovereignty of these 13 colonies that had declared their independence. Because it's very interesting, in many of the early documents, the United States is used in a plural fashion, as in we, these 13 United States. And of course, Articles of Confederation apportion that sovereignty much more in a confederal way that left huge powers to the individual states. Constitution ostensibly created a situation where the people's sovereignty was a large. It did split sovereignty, but it preferenced the sovereignty at the federal level as opposed to the state level. But of course, there was a very bloody civil war fought over that issue. And yes, even today, of course, you find debates over states' rights, interestingly, increasingly being made by in the last couple of years, certainly since the election, being made by Democratic-leaning states resistant to some of what they're seeing coming out of Republican-controlled Washington. So you have these debates ongoing still.
Correct, particularly in the case of contemporary United States, the backlash against the United States' decision to withdraw from the Global Warming Treaty in Paris. And I think the governor of New York stating that, as well as other governors and mayors and municipal leaders, that they were going to disregard what the president had done and going to, insofar as possible, try to maintain compliance with the International Warming Treaty.
Indeed. And interestingly, even I believe yesterday, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, also suggesting that he was going to challenge on states' rights grounds the tax bill, suggesting that because it was an assault on Democratic-leaning states that already paid very, very high taxes. So, yeah, you find this going on. Going back to your earlier point about how, say, Bavaria would have had representatives in other countries in, you know, before, prior to the First World War. It will be interesting to see how far municipalities, but particularly individual U.S. states, can push this. It was fascinating to see that almost immediately after Donald Trump pulled the United States out of the Paris Accord, Jerry Brown, not only with the governor of Washington and governor of New York, released a statement basically saying quite forcefully, "We're still in." And then almost immediately after that, Governor Brown went to what looked, for all intents and purposes, like a state visit to China, and sitting side by side with Xi Jinping, basically committed California to the Paris agreement. And it will be interesting to see going forward whether or not we see a more expansive efforts by particularly large states like California to conduct their own diplomacy and foreign policy, and within, of course, the constitutional limits, which do place constraints on that.
On page 37 and a little bit thereafter, you state that contrary to popular understanding, states per se are not opposed to globalization, but in fact, one of the primary contributors to the process of globalization. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, I think that this is in a section of the book where I take on the frequent argument that that sovereignty has been placed at bay, which is actually the title, Sovereignty at Bay, which is a title of an article is now more than 30 years old. The notion there was that with the rise of globalization and multinational corporations and very powerful non-government organizations, as well as powerful individuals, that, of course, the state is not the only actor on the world stage, but also that it's being placed on the ropes, because if you think about financial instability or mass migration or many other things, that states are increasingly porous by this argument, and therefore sort of we're all sort of helpless in that regard, all countries. The argument that I make is that actually the state has been the handmaiden of globalization. If national governments wanted to, they could pursue policies that are much more autarkical along the lines of, say, North Korea, et cetera. But I think that national officials have recognized over the decades, even centuries, that there are benefits to advancing and encouraging globalization, you know, and not least to be able to have countries, their citizens, take advantage of comparative advantage with regard to international trade, et cetera. Sometimes when states think that things are getting out of control, sometimes they will relinquish certain authority claims over particular areas. But at other times, they will expand their activities to try to compensate, in a sense, for the downsides of globalization. So you'll get, for instance, trade adjustment assistance or an expansion of the welfare state, in part because there have been pressures placed by globalization. So I think it's probably more fair, rather than to see globalization and the state as in entire opposition, to see them as, in a sense, growing hand in hand. State functions will increase or contract in terms of what the scope of governmental activity is and the sectors that they get involved in, to the degree that they want to benefit from globalization.
And you go into quite a bit the role of Woodrow Wilson in the story. Can you go into that for the audience and state why he was an important figure in this story?
Absolutely, and this is a timely question because on Monday, January 8th, it will be the centenary, the 100th year anniversary of Woodrow Wilson's famous Declaration of the 14 Points, which he argued should inform any post-World War I settlement, or post-Great War, as it was then known, settlement. And you know, Woodrow Wilson was a deeply flawed character in many ways, stubborn and obstinate and perhaps overly utopian in some ways, and did himself no favors when it came to the League of Nations, which was his chosen vehicle to try to organize post-war peace. Among other things, he took a very partisan approach and a very purely executive branch approach to dealing with post-war order rather than cooperating with people like Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts, who is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, over what the shape of that should be. But he is the great, he remains probably the most prominent exponent or proponent of liberal internationalism, certainly at the presidential level in American history. His notion was that the United States needed to give up its long attachment to non-entanglement, some would say isolationism, but certainly non-entanglement, which had been the recommendation of both George Washington, obviously, in his farewell address, and then Thomas Jefferson. George Washington had spoken about no permanent alliances, Thomas Jefferson about non-entanglement. And the United States had largely pursued a relatively independent course, particularly when it came to international alliances. What happened, Wilson's belief was that the world needed to be organized in a way through international institutions that could help create not a balance of power, but a collective security system in which aggression would be outlawed and the only legitimate use of force would be the combined response of the international community against aggression. And so this was what he tried to set up in his part in drafting the Covenant of the League of Nations. Obviously, that effort did not work out. And there was a huge debate, which I think is very, very compelling today, over the League of Nations. If you, one of the things that I actually begin the book with a, yes, a vignette, with a vignette that I found really fascinating. I had heard about it, but I had never read the transcript of, there's a great debate in March of 1919, just about a month after President Wilson himself had unveiled his plans for the League of Nations. He had arrived to a hero's welcome in Boston and made his way south to Washington. And a few weeks later, there was a debate between Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Republican, who was a Republican, and A. Lawrence Lowell, who was the president of Harvard University. It was an incredibly anticipated debate, according to the media, most anticipated since sort of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And it was, should the United States join the League of Nations? And reading through that transcript, it's really remarkable. There were so many of the issues that have come out now about sovereignty were front and center, including what would be the implications of this for the U.S. Constitution, for U.S. freedom of action, for instance, under the Monroe Doctrine, for the balance between executive and legislative branch? Would it infringe upon how the United States conducted its own trade policy? And finally, would it expose the United States to a flood of immigration from India and China, Japan at the time, and other places? And if you really reading it, you see so many of the same issues coming to the fore. And importantly, also, would it change the character of what the United States was and what the United States stands for in the world? Would it make it hard for the United States to behave according to its interests and its values? Ultimately, the United States, after a huge debate within Congress, ended up rejecting the Treaty of Versailles, of which the League of Nations Covenant was a prominent portion of that. And instead of taking an internationalist vocation or grabbing that mantle, the United States elected Warren Harding as its president and went into a period of what has come to be thought of as isolationism. And so for the next 20 years, and even as the international system began to crumble, not least because the United States was not a member of the League of Nations and the League proved powerless, it did have a lot of internal flaws anyway. It's uncertain whether or not U.S. membership alone would have caused it to work. But as it world order crumbled, the United States still remained staunchly isolationist, despite efforts by the presidency of the president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, to try to get the United States more involved. It was only after Pearl Harbor that basically ended isolationism in the United States, at least for some time. And obviously, once engaged in World War II, their liberal internationalists sort of came out of the woodwork, and they had a second chance to try to realize some of the goals that Wilson had put forward, but in a slightly more realist way. And you see this within the United Nations structure, where you have a Security Council where the United States, as one of the five permanent members, has a veto. So there was it was less that the United there had been a big concern that the United States would have been constrained or been compelled to do things under the League of Nations. And there were real efforts made by Franklin Roosevelt and after him, Harry Truman, including to work with the leading Republicans of the day to not make those sort of mistakes that Wilson made. So, you know, Wilson, in a sense, was a flawed prophet of liberal internationalism, but in a sense was a prophet of U.S. global leadership, which the United States, for more than seven decades after the Second World War, really pursued. And now the question is, in the age of Donald Trump, is that era definitively over, or is this simply a brief parenthesis before we go back to the way it was beforehand?
Going back to that debate, when I read it, and it was an extremely good vignette, I'm impressed that you were able to pull that up and expand on it. I thought to myself, oh, this is a very good debate because it illustrates two of the opposing views, but I suppose if we wanted to have for that time period, an all-encompassing debate, you'd really have four points of views, the two Lodge and Lowell, Lowell being more liberal internationalist, a little bit akin to, say, at that point, ex-President Taft, and Lodge being a more conservative internationalist, closer to Theodore Roosevelt. And then the two viewpoints which were not at the debate, one was a more absolute isolationist of a conservative nature like Senator William Borah, and the other one, completely absent, probably even from political perspective, was a sort of socialist isolationist of, say, someone like intellectual figure, not a political figure, Randolph Bourne, or if you wanted a more contemporary incarnation, Senator Sanders.
Yes, I think very much so. What's interesting, I absolutely agree. And one of the points that I try to make is that ultimately Wilson's version of internationalism and let's say Lodge's version of internationalism, which I call sort of great power internationalism, because there's no question that Lodge was an internationalist and it was not opposed to the League under any circumstance. He simply wanted it to have, as he made quite clear, wanted to make it compatible with U.S. constitutional system and U.S. freedom of action, and obviously offered his own 14 reservations to go as counterpoint to the 14 points of Woodrow Wilson. But ultimately, the great power internationalism and the liberal internationalism and canceled each other out. There was not enough common ground to get that. Perhaps as you suggested, the Taft as being sort of a bit more of a sort of an intervening between Wilson and Lodge. There was not enough effort to make common ground to achieve that. As a result of that, by default, the folks who, in a sense, won or were the only ones left standing were the so-called irreconcilables, and many of those were like Borah himself, just really much more isolationist in their viewpoint. It's interesting what you say about the socialist internet isolationist, and of course there were socialist internationalists at that point, but very quickly, I think, during the interwar period, many of after some initial flirtation with the Bolshevik Revolution, for instance, the climate was not particularly congenial for a major socialist movement in the United States, and that's often been the case.
And would you say a figure a little bit further on in the story, Senator Vandenberg, a very important figure in terms of American post-World War II international relations, and in particular the construction of NATO, the Marshall Plan, etc. Would you say he's a progeny of Lodge or Lowell or some combination therein?
I think probably a little bit. You know, he had aspects. I mean, that's obviously a Midwestern Republican who probably is a little bit more on the isolationist side of things than Lodge, I would say. And his conversion to internationalism is absolutely pivotal, and also the fact that that both the Roosevelt and Truman administrations really took pains to reach out to him, I think was extraordinary and of extraordinary importance, and actually bear some relevance to our current state of play in terms of hyper partisanship. It's really remarkable the degree to which the Roosevelt administration under Cordell Hull attempted to during the Dumbarton Oaks talks, when the foundations of the United Nations were being discussed by the United States, the UK, the Soviet Union, and later China as well, the Kuomintang government. There was a real effort to try to persuade Vandenberg that this was far from any sort of starry-eyed utopian vision that would deprive the United States of its sovereignty, and that was a theme that was harped on constantly. And Vandenberg himself had said that Pearl Harbor had ended isolationism for any realist. And so, but in his mind, the question was, well, what sort of, so then the question became, what sort of internationalism should the United States embrace? And, again, also during the Truman administration, you had Secretary of State Acheson working very, very closely with Vandenberg to try to assure him that this would not in any way create an automatic commitment on the part of the United States to go to war against any aggressor to NATO allies, while at the same time, of course, trying to persuade America's NATO allies of exactly the reverse, that this was an ironclad guarantee, and some very deft both domestic and international diplomacy on Acheson's side to try to win Vandenberg over to approving NATO.
Yes, in fact, in his memoirs written 20 years later, Acheson was still complaining about the need to cultivate Vandenberg and his Democratic opposite number, Senator Connally of Texas.
Indeed. That's a being able to win them both over was quite a feat.
Now, there was a bit of a backlash in the 50s, which you go into relating to something called the Bricker Amendment. Can you go into that?
Yes. The Bricker Amendment was the handiwork of Senator John Bricker, and it was an effort to try to ensure that the United States would not join UN treaties, in particular UN human rights treaties, and it placed enormous hurdles. It would have placed enormous constitutional hurdles, requiring not only the normal supermajority to approve any treaty, but also to have state legislatures of the United States approve of these treaties. And the motivation for the Bricker Amendment was not strictly preserving American sovereignty, but specifically was racial politics. I think there was growing concern that the human rights instruments that were being negotiated could be used by proponents of, say, integration and desegregation and civil rights in the United States to try to improve the plight, particularly of African Americans, and not simply in the South, but nationwide. And a lot of people who had sort of racialist attitudes and wanted to maintain those status hierarchies keep Jim Crow laws, etc., basically saw this as and not for the last time, I saw this these UN instruments as potential efforts to try to change the United States from the outside. And this amendment came perilously close being passed, only the intervention of the Eisenhower administration and the personal intervention of the president himself prevented this by only a single vote from passage. Now, one of the costs of that, though, was that the Eisenhower administration promised members of Congress that it would not seek ratification of any UN treaty, human rights treaty, during its term in office. And that legacy has lived on, it helps explain why the United States took so long to approve human rights instruments, 40 years in the case of the Genocide Convention and several others. And it testifies to the difficulty with which, particularly when it comes to human rights, the United States has had in ratifying many human rights instruments, partly for ideological reasons at times. For instance, we've never ratified the UN Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, although we have ratified the Convention on Civil and Political Rights. Another more recent example, which I cite in the book, is this sort of rather bizarre rejection of the UN Convention on the Rights with Persons with Disabilities by the Senate, despite the fact that it was actually modeled on the Americans with Disabilities Act and would simply be an international projection of that treaty, which had passed under George H.W. Bush, obviously a Republican president, and just the sort of bizarre types of accusations that were bandied about why this was an affront to the American way of life by people like Senator Orrin Hatch and others.
Would it be accurate to say that Bricker's contemporary equivalents, like former Ambassador Bolton, their view of sovereignty or alleged violations therein in terms of American sovereignty is opportunistic rather than principled? So, for example, I don't think they've ever protested American employment of the sort of SWIFT-like sanctions vis-a-vis foreign countries, even though that involves great violations of these other countries' sovereignty.
Yeah, I think that there's a huge you put your finger on what is a huge contradiction in U.S. approach to sovereignty, and that's our sovereignty versus sovereignty for others. The United States has, to some degree, this is bipartisan, but I think it's the willingness to violate other sovereignty in recent years has been perhaps slightly stronger on the conservative side of the fence. But the idea here is that the United States, for a long time, has been much more concerned about making rules for others than for having rules made for itself, and also much more dedicated to preserving its own sovereignty versus violating the sovereignty of others. This has been particularly noteworthy in the evolution of notions of contingent sovereignty, and the notion, which is not simply American, I should hasten to add, that sovereignty is not absolute but contingent. And the most well-known example of that is what has become known as the responsibility to protect doctrine, which came out in the 2005 high-level, or was endorsed at the 2005 high-level summit of member states of the United Nations, which says that if a country commits atrocities or allows atrocities to be committed on its territory, then it violates it has violated fundamental obligations to protect its people, and therefore that responsibility to protect devolves to the international community. But that's not the only aspect of contingent sovereignty. An argument that the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, made quite strongly was the notion that if a state sponsors or harbors terrorists, or if it pursues weapons of mass destruction in contradiction to its international obligations, that it, in a sense, forfeits the right to freedom from external intervention. And so, yes, the United States has been very good through, you know, some of these Treasury Department sanctions and other things violating through the use of force the sovereignty of other countries, but also making its own laws extraterritorial to try to induce behavior change in other countries, and that is a very controversial practice, and one that elicits often criticisms not only from U.S. adversaries but also from U.S. allies.
You wrote a piece in Foreign Policy back in, I think it was the summer of 2011, supporting R2P. Do you still support it? A lot of the previous exponents of it, like Michael Ignatieff of Canada, have more or less backed away from their support of it.
I still support the concept. I think that its execution and implementation have left a lot to be desired. It was always going to be a highly sensitive thing to try to implement. I think that it would be wrong to say that countries get a free pass. I do think that if states are governments, regimes are committing atrocities, ethnic cleansing, you know, mass campaigns of rape, genocide, etc., that if they are doing that, I think that there's a moral obligation for the international community not to look the other way. The difficulty has been that, and this came out in the wake of the Libya intervention in particular, the difficulty has been that some cases are less clear-cut than others. And in that case, there was a strong argument made by Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, that if the international community didn't act, that Muammar Gaddafi was going to order the the execution, the murder of thousands of Libyan opponents, including innocent civilians caught in the crossfire. In the wake of that intervention, which was approved by the UN Security Council, the China and Russia and some African countries as well objected that the United States had turned that and its Western allies had turned that UN Security Council resolution into a license for regime change. There's a lot of debate as to whether or not they should have known, given the wording, that that was going to be the most likely outcome. But still, be that as it may, certain countries governments have tried to offer some qualifications, the responsibility to protect. One of them is this notion that was offered by the Brazilians called responsibility while protecting. And that basically means that it's incumbent upon any intervening coalition to regularly return to the UN Security Council and the United Nations more broadly to explain just how it is actually fulfilling this, and that there could be an opportunity to, in a sense, countermand that initial verdict that, yes, it's okay to go in to try to perform these operations for humanitarian purposes. The difficulty with it operationally is that there's no such thing as a purely humanitarian intervention. You inevitably are getting involved as a political actor on the ground, and then you also have responsibility for what happens afterwards. I think one of the things that left a hugely bad taste in people's mouths with respect to Libya was the fact that there was virtually no follow-up afterwards, and so the situation in Libya has been one of great chaos and violence and instability, and offering opportunities for extremism as well ever since that intervention. So one wonders whether or not it would have been better to leave Gaddafi in place. Arguments can be made on both sides of that equation.
Going a little bit backwards, would you say that the policies of America Unbound, as it was termed at the time of George Bush the Younger, do they prefigure in terms of not only sovereignty, but general foreign policy, the policies of the current administration?
George W. Bush was determined, even before 9/11, he and his senior advisors, to try to escape some of the constraints of multilateral diplomacy. And I think In those cases, it was largely about increasing U.S. freedom of action and autonomy at a time when the United States was riding high. It was at the height, in a sense, of the unipolar moment. At the tail end of the Clinton administration, even the French foreign minister had talked about the United States as a hyperpower. The administration came in basically renouncing a number of different multilateral agreements and bilateral agreements as well, including the anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia. And it was, you know, to some degree, I think, posturing and symbolic politics against, you know, to try to draw the contrast with an administration that had been seen as overly multilateralist and not strong enough, particularly in security terms, the Clinton administration, by its Republican critics. Now, what happened after 9/11 was that despite an initial turn towards some sort of coalitional multilateralism, the United States really determined to declare, I mean, the Bush administration declared a global war on terrorism and really would brook no interference in how it was going to go about prosecuting that war. And it's at least particularly in the first term, had a very, very unilateralist bent to it. And I would say that the Trump administration, although I should say, interestingly, though, by the end of the second term, the Bush administration had come back to the United Nations and other international organizations again and again to try to for burden sharing and legitimacy for its purposes. So I think even the administration of George W. Bush recognized that that going it alone was not a viable option in the long run, that there had to be some level of multilateralism. In terms of the Trump administration, you know, I think that, you know, in some ways they've borrowed from the Bush administration and the notion that the United States should not be unbound. But I think that there's a far even more it's a reaction against the Bush administration because the neoconservative agenda that was riding high in the Bush administration really believed that you could make remake foreign societies in the American image, and that the United States stood for the documents at the time, for the non-negotiable demands of human dignity. And the second national security strategy that the Bush administration put out was almost entirely about democracy promotion around the world. And, you know, I think that, you know, what was distinctive about Donald Trump during the campaign was, and also, frankly, Bernie Sanders in particular on the Democratic side, was the degree to which they were channeling a widespread revulsion amongst the American public with this sort of unending nation building adventures and interventions and wars around the world. And so Donald Trump came in with a much more, some might say, cynical view that the United States is not, you know, shouldn't be concerned about human rights and democracy around the world, but also a sense that I think channeling a sense amongst many Americans that to be interested in human rights and democracy around the world inevitably drove you to actually engage in foreign adventures that were very costly in terms of blood and treasure. I think that's an overreading. I think they've swerved the pendulum too much in the opposite direction, so that the United States appears to be simply a cynical great power that doesn't really care about human rights under this president, and who has an unfortunate tendency to cozy up to dictators rather than making some sort of moral differentiation between those that behave ethically and actually trust their citizens and those that are simply authoritarian. But be that as it may, I think that the overreaching of the Bush administration, and even to some degree of the more realist and cautious Obama administration, because obviously we maintained our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, that I think put a very bad taste in the mouth of the Trump administration. Final thing I'd say about Donald Trump is that, you know, it's, in many ways he is a throwback to the interwar period, that is particularly the 1930s, because he has explicitly invoked the notion of America First, which, well, of course, the America First movement was a desire to keep the United States out of the Second World War. And, you know, that's a phrase that obviously Charles Lindbergh and others who were isolationists at the time and basically said, look, we need to worry about the United States first, middle and last. And, you know, obviously it's not, has not been entirely isolationist with respect to Donald Trump, but you see a sort of sense that others have been, in his mind, others have been freeloading on American efforts. It's time for them to shoulder their own burden. He's cast some doubt on the solidity of American defense commitments to longstanding allies. So you see a tendency to want to be much more selective in terms of international involvement.
Would you say that the alleged obsession, American obsession with the sovereignty is exacerbated by the perceived decline of American power in the last, say, 10 years?
I think so. There's a sense that sovereignty is more at bay now than it has been. I think there's also the global economic crisis actually plays into it to some degree as well. Sovereignty is obviously contentious when it comes to international treaties and organizations, and I think that the fact that the United States has been feeling overstretched, or Americans have been feeling overstretched, and they're aware that other countries are on the rise, not least China, makes them wonder whether or not they should be a little bit more attuned to geopolitical competition and be able to have more freedom of action so that they're not constrained in that competition. Another thing, though, I think that's happened on the economic front is that, for a long time, the international economy, the global economy since the end of the Second World War has depended upon the United States to act as a leader in a number of different ways. To basically maintain its market as open so that it always is, in a sense, is an insurance valve to keep global growth humming along. I think what has happened partly with the rise of inequality in the United States and also in response to the Great Recession, where, so many Americans took a big hit. I think that there was a sense that Donald Trump was able to channel that the United States was in decline. Its infrastructure was in horrible shape. Jobs were being exported overseas. And to some degree, this was because the United States had, in his view, signed up to terrible, quote unquote, terrible and awful trade deals, and that we needed to regain some sense of control, which in his mind was a large degree of what sovereignty is about, right? Is can you actually determine your own fate? I think, there are a lot of reasons, obviously, why American workforce has suffered. They can't all be laid at the feet of globalization. A lot of it has to do with, obviously, innovation and advances in different sorts of technologies, et cetera. The other thing, though, is that the United States has, under Republican and Democratic administrations, has done much less than it has promised over the decades to try to deal with retraining and preparing the workforce to deal with global competition. We actually have those sovereign capabilities. We just haven't been using them. But I think that there's no question that this whole sense of downward expectations, as opposed to the notion that life is going to get better for your children. I think for a huge swath of the electorate, one of the appeals of Donald Trump was this notion that he was speaking for the common man. However, whether one takes that, seriously in terms of his own policies or believes he's simply a plutocrat in populist clothing, there's no question that it resonated quite a bit for a large swath of the American electorate.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
It would be that American sovereignty is secure. The United States is in no danger of sacrificing any of its independence and its constitution. But it will increasingly need to make some compromises to its freedom of action to gain the benefits of international cooperation in a complicated, interdependent world.
Well, thank you very much, Stuart. This has been very enjoyable. This is Charles Cottier, Royal Historical Society, for New Book Networks. Thank you.
Thank you.